So now we get to come to this book and see the beauties that are there, the beauties that await us this morning. I'm very excited about the things that I've learned in this passage. So I don't know about you, but this passage on the foot washing, when Jesus washes the feet of the disciples, it's been at some level confusing to me about what it's really about. What am I supposed to take away from this? And at one level, it's obvious. I should wash your feet, right? That's simple. But at another level, I was always a little bit confused by that. And maybe we'll see why in a moment. But last week, we started in the first verse of chapter 13. Now, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Or we could say, to the end, he loved them. So this verse introduces not just our sermon and our text for this morning, it introduces the whole second half of John. So remembering those things. In the first half, John emphasized Jesus' saving mission to the world, right? In the second half, he's going to emphasize the special love of Jesus for his own. What a beautiful thing. So now we go on to read in verse 2. And now we begin. Here we go, second half of John, kind of more officially this week. Verse 2, during supper, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, or to hand him over. I want to stop there just for a minute and ask, how does John know what was already in Judas's heart? I mean, obviously the easy answer is, well, God told him. Inspiration, right? But I don't know, sometimes that's a little bit simplistic. I think among other things, perhaps it was certainly known later that Judas had already made an arrangement with the chief priests. So, I mean, John is going to know that very soon. Judas just doesn't all of a sudden show up with the chief priests without a previous arrangement having been made and an agreement made. So while they're here in this, at this, John doesn't use the word the upper room, but we know it's in the upper room. While they're in the upper room and preparing for this supper, Judas has already been meeting with the chief priests, and they have already agreed to give him money if he will hand him over to them in the absence of a crowd. Jesus knows that. He knows that. He knows what's in Judas's heart. And John tells us that he does, only not in the way we would expect him to tell us. In other words, he doesn't say, Jesus, knowing what was in Judas's heart, he says, instead, during supper, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. See, I kind of expect knowing what was in Judas's heart, but no, the implication is that Jesus does know. He does know. But Jesus knows more than that. Jesus sees in that thing which he knows the deeper thing he knows, that the Father has given all things into his hands, and that he has come forth from God and is going back to God. Jesus sees Judas and his plans and his purposes only in the light of God's plans and God's purposes. So John follows up this reference to what the devil puts in Judas's heart with the reference to Jesus knowing that the Father's given all things into his hands. He's come from God and is going back to God. And I think, man, could there be any bigger incongruity? In other words, could there be any two things more opposed to each other? God has given all things into Jesus' hands, and Judas is going to betray Jesus to his death. Now, to speak of the Father giving all things into Jesus' hands, what does that mean? What is Jesus knowing when he knows that? That's the language of the most exalted kind of power, of sovereignty, of dominion. Right? So hand in the Bible is, in the Bible, a synonym in your handout for power and sovereignty. Just two examples, but we could multiply examples, especially from the Old Testament. Truly in this city they were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand, your sovereign hand, your purpose predestined to occur. And now, Lord, take note of their threats and grant that your bondservants may speak your word with all confidence while you extend your hand to heal. And signs and wonders take place through the name of your holy servant Jesus. 1 Peter 5. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. So when John speaks of the Father having given all things into Jesus' hand, it's saying basically the Father has given all things into his power. He's given all things into his power. Now remember, what is it that God has given into the power of Jesus, as it were? All things. And what does that mean? John chapter 5. For not even the Father judges anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son, so that all will honor the Son as they honor the Father. Just as the Father has life in himself, so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself. And he gave him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. So when John says that Jesus knew the Father had given all things into his hands, that's the language of universal power, dominion, and sovereignty. Now, we're going to set this up because we're like, hey, let's just get to the foot washing. Right? That's the part I like, right? But wait a minute. We're going to spend the majority of our time right here so that we get the foot washing when it comes, because we will miss it entirely if we're not careful. On the one hand, think about this. Only one who partakes fully of all that the undivided God is. There's only one God. You cannot divide God into parts. And only one, therefore, who partakes fully of all that God is could ever wield or possess universal lordship. Who alone can you attribute universal lordship to? One who possesses all that God is, as it were. On the other hand, we're going to do a lot of on the other hands today. Only the incarnate Son, the Son in the flesh, could be what? What's the word there? It's in your text. Could be given this prerogative of deity. How do you give to someone the prerogative of deity? Who must he be? If you're going to speak like that, he must be the incarnate Son. Remember, we do not divide Jesus into two persons. Now, this is where I talk about the book, right? We need to understand this. We do not divide Jesus, as we so often can do, practically speaking, in our brains, into two persons. We must not allow the fact that there are two distinct natures, his humanity and his deity. We must not allow that to distract us or to undermine the reality that he is only one, what? One person. One person. One person. And so we see that it is only the incarnate Son the enfleshed Word, who could ever be given what? Universal power and dominion and sovereignty. Is that not a mystery, brothers and sisters? And is not that the mystery in which our salvation is rooted and founded? It's the mystery of the incarnation. Now, Jesus knew that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God. Let's just explore that for a moment. Here also is the language of universal dominion and sovereignty and lordship. Jesus is going to say in chapter 17, "Now, Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was." On the one hand, you ready? On the one hand, only one who partakes fully of all that the undivided God is could ever ask something like this. Right? Who else can ask to be glorified together with God? Together with God? Or claim to have shared in the Father's glory before the world ever was? Who else? But wait a minute. On the other hand, only the incarnate Son could ever pray. Could ever pray to the Father, asking the Father to glorify himself in the future with the glory he had before the world was. This is the person of Christ. So when John says Jesus knowing these things, this is what we're seeing is who Jesus is. Now let me ask you this question. Who knew that he had come forth from God? Who knew that? Jesus did. Jesus knew that who came forth from God? He did. Can we ask which part of him came forth from God? This is not just for the fun of it. Can we ask which part of Jesus came forth from God? His humanity or his deity? Can we ask that question? In one sense, yes, because on the one hand, we confess that the eternal Word became flesh in the fullness of time. And there was no human nature that came down out of heaven from God. There was no human nature in heaven that one day came down out of heaven from God. On the other hand, brothers and sisters, it is not enough to say only that the eternal Word came from God. That is not enough. What do we confess? We confess this as a doctrine of our faith. We confess that it was the glorious, undivided person of the incarnate Son, the enfleshed Word, Jesus himself. He knew he had come from God and he was going back to God. He did not sit there thinking, well, this part of me. No, he came from God. The incarnate Word was going back to God. The very one who came from God. Of whom else could such things ever be said? You see, what does this have to do with our text? Everything. So on the one hand, we emphasize that the Father gives all things into Jesus' hands. That's appropriate to his deity. On the other hand, we emphasize that the Father gives all things into Jesus' hands. That's appropriate to his humanity. On the one hand, we emphasize that Jesus came from God and is going back to God. That's appropriate to his deity. On the other hand, we emphasize that Jesus came from God and he is going back to God. That's appropriate to his true humanity. And yet, in all that we just said, and all those on the one hand and on the other hands, there's only one undivided person of whom every single one of those things, on this hand and on that hand, they can all be said equally and with equal truth of the single person of Jesus Christ. Now, it's only in the light of these things, in the light of this mystery of Christ's person as the incarnate Son, the enfleshed Word, that we can ever understand the significance of these words, or what happens next. During supper, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, universal power, dominion, and sovereignty, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, glory and honor, got up from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Our first mistake is if we think that this is first of all about an example to us. When we understand who it is that's doing this, we must understand there's no parallel at some level. There's no parallel between me washing your feet and Jesus washing your feet. Now, there is an example here, but we cannot understand the example. It will remain inaccessible to us unless we get what this is really about. So we might think, oh, what a wonderful example for me to follow, and we're going to see. That's right as far as it goes. The problem is it's not the first thing we ought to be thinking or the primary thing. When Jesus lays aside his garments and girds himself with a towel and washes the disciples' feet, that is not, first of all, an example. It is rather, first of all, a revelation. A revelation of the meaning of his person. Do you see why we spent so much time now looking at the person of Jesus, which we saw in that opening verse? There's a reason that John told us. Jesus, knowing these things, that's his person. Now look what this person does. And what does what he does tell us about the meaning of his person? It's a revelation of who he is, and therefore what he has come to do and to accomplish, and what only he can do and accomplish. Here in this act is not, first of all, an example for you or for me to follow, not first of all, but rather a revelation of what the incarnation means, what it means that the eternal Word has taken to himself our flesh, our humanity. So John describes the scene, as is typical, very vividly, as one who was there, who saw, who experienced this whole event. He has seven verbs in rapid succession. You know, usually you have a sentence with one or two verbs. There's seven of them. We start with the first four. Jesus got up from supper. So you see it. John is seeing it in his mind's eye. He laid aside his garments. He took a towel. He girded himself with the towel. Now, if we're the disciples, all of our most basic, fundamental sensibilities are being offended right now. Because this is the dress of the lowliest and the most menial kind of, in your handout, slave. Slave. Now, we got to get over something here, and I'm going to work hard to help us, to help me, because we, oh, isn't that noble? That's just so noble. I love it when people do that. When big politicians stoop to do things humble. We'll never get this if we think that way. This is the dress appropriate only to the most lowly and the most menial kind of service. So dressed in this way, now he's dressed in this way as a slave, the lowliest kind of slave, doing the lowliest kind of thing, we get the next three verbs. He poured water into the basin. We see it unfolding before our eyes. He began to wash the disciples' feet. He wiped their feet with the towel with which he was girded. So I do think that in many ways there's a sense in which we can romanticize and sentimentalize the washing of someone else's feet. And that's one particular reason why, there's reasons I don't believe the Lord assigned this as an institution and an ordinance for us to observe today. But I will say that washing people's feet has lost entirely. When Christians wash people's feet today, it has nothing to do with what Jesus was doing in the upper room. Something else entirely was going on there. There's nothing particularly low about washing someone else's feet in our culture. In Christian circles, it's even a noble thing to do, if somewhat uncomfortable, perhaps. But we must, by all means, learn to see this differently. So, in the Old Testament, we're going to have a shift. In the Old Testament, water could be brought for your feet to be washed, but you washed your own feet. I bring you water to wash your feet as a good host, as one who cared about you, and one who wanted to show good hospitality. But you washed your feet. Unless, of course, I had a very, very low and menial slave, probably not from my household, not even from my people, maybe a slave from a foreign people captured in war, maybe. So we read in Genesis 18, Abraham said to the men, "Let a little water be brought and wash your feet." Oh, was Abraham too proud to wash their feet? Is that what his problem was? "Rest yourselves under the tree." Lot said to the men, and Lot is being set before us as a paragon, as an example of hospitality. "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet." Well, Lot, be humble. You wash their feet. Genesis 24, Abraham's steward came to the house of Laban, and there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. So he washed his feet. They didn't wash his feet. The man of Ephraim brought the Levite into his house, and they washed their own feet and ate and drank. When Abigail met David on the mountain path, what did Abigail say to David? She rose, she bowed with her face to the ground, and she said, "And he has come to take her as his wife," which I assume there was some known arrangement. Some things had been said, right? And so she bows to the ground and says, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." She's not saying literally that she's going to wash the feet of the servants of David. It's like Saul saying, and Gideon, "Who is my family? They're the least in Israel." No, they're not literally the least. It's just the way you talked. It's they're not being insincere, but it's just the way you expressed an attitude of humility. So she does not, neither does she expect that she will be asked to wash their feet. She doesn't think once she's married to David, David's going to say, "Wash the feet of my servants." He's not going to do that. And she's not going to do that. What she's doing is she's using the ultimate example of the lowest work of the lowest slave to express the proper culturally acceptable posture or attitude in those circumstances. It's just the way that you did it. So here's my question for us. Is the refusal to ever wash someone else's feet, is that a sign of self-importance? Is that automatically a sign of pride and arrogance? Not at all. It was just a recognition in your handout. We're going to use this word a few times this morning, of the fitness of things, of what was right, of what was appropriate. That's all. So let me ask this. If you're a person, and let's say you allowed your feet to be washed by the lowest and most menial of slaves, you said, "Yes, I'll let you wash my feet." Does that mean that you're lording it over the slave? Does that mean you're being arrogant? You're treating him arrogantly? Not at all. That's just a legitimate cultural recognition that there are various stations in life. The Old Testament saints were not less godly because they didn't wash each other's feet or other people's feet. It was just the way of things. Okay? So it's only when we really understand this. Again, we are not stratified into classes, into we're all about equality and all of this kind of thing. And in a sense, that's a good thing. There's some goodness to that, as we see in our culture, is some badness, a lot of badness to that. But when we see a political, someone high up doing something humble, we look at it and we call it noble. And so we wonder, we look at the disciples and we're like, "Well, why didn't they see it was noble? They must have been really arrogant." No, that's missing the entire point. This is not for them about humility. It's about fitness. It's about what's appropriate, what's right. Only when we understand that can we understand what is happening in these verses. Otherwise, we will miss it to the end of our days. We will never see the true beauty of what Jesus does. And so in and of itself, there was nothing at all noble about this act. Remember that. By itself, what Jesus does is not noble. There wasn't remotely any way for any of us to romanticize or sentimentalize this act. What a beautiful act. No. It was simply not fitting. It was not right. It was not appropriate. Unless you are who Jesus is. Do you see that? Unless you are who Jesus is, this is not fitting. In other words, there is a sense in which it was more fitting for Jesus to wash someone's feet than it was for King David. We'll see that in just a moment. But maybe now then we can appreciate or understand at least Peter's response. So Jesus came to Simon Peter. Peter said to him, "Lord, Do you wash my feet? Do we condemn Peter for being, are we so quick to condemn him now for being too proud to let Jesus wash his feet? Luke tells us that a dispute arose about this time among the disciples as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. Now we have to be careful, because when we hear the greatest, we think, I am the greatest. I'm better than all of you, right? But they're thinking in terms of fitness in the kingdom. There's the greatest and there's the least, and that's the way things are. It's the way things have always been and the way things will be. Even now, they're that way. So in our culture, we hear that, we think, what a terrible, bald-faced example of arrogance. I mean, how did even Jesus pick these guys? They're so full of pride and conceit. It's reprehensible. It's despicable. I think when we respond like that, we're missing the picture. I'm not saying there's no pride in their hearts. No doubt there was. But we do need to understand that their dispute is to some extent legitimate. To some extent. At least in light of the cultural fitness of things. Of the various assigned stations in life. The Bible recognizes there are the least, there are the greatest. And so in a sense, the disciples were disputing among themselves about the fitness of things in the kingdom. It's this sense of fitness, then, that leads Peter to say to Jesus, Lord, do you wash my feet? Where's the fitness in that, in how things are? In the Greek, it's you and mine are emphatic. They're the first words. It's just you, me. And they're placed in direct opposition to each other. You, mine, wash the feet? This isn't about pride or power or self-importance. It is, but not first. It's not even about humility. It's not even about humility. Not first. It's just about what's fitting. What's right. Not even the most righteous kings of old, not even David himself ever did such a thing. It just wasn't fitting. We might assume that even Moses, who in his day was more humble than all people who were on the face of the earth, never did such a thing. You, mine, wash the feet. Peter thinks he knows who Jesus is. But if he knew who Jesus is, he would understand washing feet. There's a sense in which the whole world for Peter, for the rest of the disciples, is at this moment being turned what? Upside down. And I'm not exaggerating, that's not just a dramatic turn of phrase. We should be able now to sympathize fully and even empathize. So often we come to this passage and we're like, I am so irritated with those disciples, particularly with Peter. Why didn't he get it? I think this is so beautiful. I think this is so noble. And that just proves, if we come to that, we don't see it. We need to learn to sympathize and empathize with them, how they were feeling, what they were thinking. If this act of Jesus was primarily about setting an example of just humility in and of itself, well then you know what? The disciples could legitimately respond, as Peter does, this isn't about humility. It's about the shattering of everything right and fitting. This is not intended, though, primarily as an example of humility. Then what is it? Are you seeing already? If it's not an example of humility, first of all, at least in and of itself, what is it? Jesus answered and said to Peter, "What I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand after these things." No, you see what Jesus is telling Peter? He's kind of telling him, it's impossible for you to understand. You can't. And you won't ever understand until later. Then you'll be able to. And we ask, why? Why can't he just explain now? You know, what's so hard about explaining now? And the answer is that there are no words that can explain. The answer is that the foot washing can only be fully understood only in the light of an event that has not yet happened. Do you see now it's not just about an example of humility? Because an example of humility you can understand at any time. But this, they cannot understand. But Peter doesn't understand why he can't understand. He doesn't understand why he shouldn't be able to understand. So Peter said to Jesus, "Never shall you wash my feet." Are you with Peter? Just for the sake of it? Can you feel Peter? He is emboldened by the rightness, or in your handout, the righteousness of his cause. I mean, he's got a bunch of righteous, he's got a cause to stand on. "Never shall you wash my feet." Jesus answered Peter, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head." Now, I've always been a little confused by this. What's Peter doing? Peter thinks he understands now. "Ah," he says, "I got it." Or he hopes he does. But he doesn't. Jesus said he couldn't. He thinks that this is about a ceremonial kind of a cleansing that pictures spiritual cleansing. So he thinks this is about cleansing. And therefore, if cleansing is what this is all about, because when you look at foot washing, you're kind of like, oh, that is about cleansing, but not primarily. It's about service and lowly serving. But if this is just about cleansing, then of course he wants Jesus to wash not just his feet, but his hands and his head. In other words, do you know what Peter's thinking? "Don't just wash my feet like a slave. Wash my hands and my head too. That would look better. Like a master providing cleansing for his servants." Now, you see what he's thinking. Peter is trying to turn his world right side up again. He's trying to see this foot washing as something that is somehow fitting. He's trying to avoid what Jesus said he cannot yet understand. And in the process, what is he doing? He's suggesting for the second time now, without meaning to, that he knows better than Jesus. "Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head." Now, I believe the key to understanding the flow of this passage is to see that the next verses are peripheral. They're a digression. In other words, Peter's excited because he thought this was about a slave serving someone. And that bothered him. But now, it's about cleaning. And so he tries to forget that Jesus is girded as a slave and tries to think of this in a different light of cleansing. So Jesus says, okay, for the sake of correction, I will entertain this idea for just a moment. For the sake of correcting you. Jesus said to Peter, "He who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you, plural, you all, except for Judas, are clean, but not all of you." For he knew the one who was betraying him. For this reason, he said, "Not all of you are clean." We'll come back to that idea next week. So you hear that. I'm looking at the way we look at the disciples, we're kind of like, are they really even believers yet? Are they really clean? But Jesus says, you know, there's a lot you don't understand. There's a lot you can't understand until later. But your faith in God and your faith in his promise of salvation, which you've demonstrated by believing in me and following me, means that you're already clean, Peter. You're already clean. Isn't it good to hear Jesus say that to us? You're clean. So, insofar as Peter is thinking about cleansing, then Jesus wants him to know he's already been washed, he's already clean. That's the encouragement. Therefore, insofar as Peter is thinking of cleansing, what he asks for is totally misguided. Totally unnecessary. Because he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet. That's the correction. And so Peter needs to learn that even in all his sincere zeal, he can never outdo Jesus. The main point, therefore, of this verse is not for us to go away with this big lesson about, well, once I'm saved, I'm washed, but I still need to confess my sins on a daily basis. That's true, but it's not the main point. It's actually a detour here. It's a digression. Jesus mentions that only basically to correct Peter. And so the main point is, Peter, you're already clean, and therefore your request, no matter how exuberant or sincere it might be, is just misguided. It's unnecessary. You cannot outdo me, Peter. And so Peter's put back right where he was before. He cannot yet have his world turned right side up again. He cannot escape the reality that Jesus did dress himself as a slave, and he has washed, not my head, not my hands, only my feet. Jesus will not allow Peter to avoid what he cannot yet understand. But we can understand today, can't we? What did Jesus say? What I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand after these things. Now, I have every single one of these next points starred. So, let's just, I pray that this is the clincher. Once Jesus has been crucified and raised, then it will be seen that when Jesus laid aside his garments and girded himself with a towel, and wash the disciples' feet. This was more appropriate to Jesus than it was to David. It was more appropriate to Jesus to wash the feet than it would have ever been to Moses or to any of the saints of old. Because this act was first of all a revelation of the meaning of his own person. And there is no other person like who Jesus is. This is a revelation of the meaning of who he is, and therefore what only he has come to do. When Jesus has been crucified and raised, and only then, will it be seen that this act was first of all a revelation of what the incarnation means. And the same could not ever be said for David or Moses if they had ever washed someone's feet. Of what in fact, it would have been not fitting at some levels for David to wash someone's feet. It was fitting for Jesus, given his person. It's a picture, a revelation of what it means that the eternal Word has taken to himself our flesh, our humanity. When Jesus girds himself as a slave and then performs as a slave the lowliest service of the lowliest slave, this act, watch this now, it is a revelation not just of Christ's humanity, which we are maybe quick to see. It is a revelation of his deity. It's a revelation, Jesus washing the feet is a revelation of his deity as the incarnate Word. In other words, the only way that this act can make any sense at all is to understand that the one who performs it is the incarnate Son. The enfleshed Word who has come forth from God and is going back to God. What does Jesus say to Peter? If I do not wash you, you have no part with me. You have no part with who I am. And therefore with what I have come to do. Now we can ask, why then is this foot washing necessary? It sounds to us like the cross itself, which is now only hours away, is going to make this point just as powerfully, and perhaps even more powerfully. Why does Jesus wash the disciples' feet? Now we can appreciate example. Only now. Why does he wash his disciples' feet? Because Jesus wants his disciples to understand, after these things, what the meaning of his person is, what the meaning of who he is, and what the meaning of his cross work is for life lived in his kingdom. So we go on to read in verses 12 to 16. And now what I love about this, if we have just been saved from moralisms. We have just been saved from turning this into a moralistic lesson. Now it is rooted in the person of Christ and his saving, redemptive work. So we read, so when he had washed their feet and taken his garments, and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? And in one sense, no, they don't. Not yet. You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is the one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. Only when we have understood this foot washing in the light of Christ's person can it truly be for us the example Jesus intends for it to be. And so even now, even when Jesus says this, what we need to understand is that the point is not so much humility. Yes, we are to be humble, but that is not primarily the point. It is not humility. It is more fundamentally the brand new, inside out, upside down, fitness of things in Christ's kingdom. This is not just about being humble because all the saints of old were called to be humble. This is about us living out the meaning of Christ's person who came in the fullness of time and has brought his kingdom. He is the incarnate Son. It's who he is. He is the enfleshed Word, so that he might give his life as a ransom for many. Therefore, living life in his kingdom must reflect who he is, his person, and what he has done. Therefore, the greatest among you shall wash the feet of his slaves. We're not talking about something noble in that way. We're talking about the way of things, fitness, The greatest among you shall wash the feet of his slaves. Therefore, let's put it the other way. The greatest among you, and this is the way Jesus usually puts it. We think of it, the greatest shall wash the feet of his slaves. Look what, this is how it's usually said. The greatest among you shall be the slave who washes your feet. Only in the light of Christ's person and his work on the cross can we see the beautiful, mysterious fitness. See, we look at Jesus, oh, it wasn't fit. It wasn't so much fitting that he did what he did, but it was noble that he did what he did. No, now when we understand his person, we see the beautiful, mysterious fitness of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. And so therefore, the wonderful fitness of doing to each other as he has done to us. Only in the light of Christ's person and his work on the cross can the kingdom life, that kingdom life which appeared at first, and I hope we got there with Peter for a moment this morning, it appeared at first to be inside out and upside down. Only in this light can it be seen as the only life that's truly right side up. So now we can listen, as Peter could not yet, with understanding. And that means with full obedience and joy to Jesus' words to us. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Dear Heavenly Father, oh Lord, thank you for the power of your word, and that the power of your word is rooted in the person of Jesus and the gospel itself. Thank you that you don't call us to some moralistic life of doing noble acts of humility, or of just being humble, or of trying to go about acting and being a certain way. You call us to live in light of the person of our Savior, in light of the new fitness of things in the kingdom of the incarnate Son, the enfleshed Word. Teach us by your Spirit what this means. May our world be turned inside out and upside down, so that it might then be turned right side out and right side up again. So that as Jesus has done to us in the uniqueness of his person, we might then do to others. Because that's the way it is. That's the way things are in the kingdom of Christ. We ask these things, Lord, for the sake of your name and your glory in our midst, in our lives, in our families, in our homes. And we thank you now that we can continue preparing our hearts for this supper. In Jesus' name, amen.